You're listening to a programme from BBC Radio 4.
All Things Bright and Beautiful has been consistently popular since its publication in 1848. However, verse 3 is rarely included in modern performances.
The rich man in his castle, the poor man at his gate, he made them high and lowly, he ordered their estate.
If asked to guess, many people might say it was the First World War that put paid to the notion that wealth and poverty were divinely preordained. The war certainly focused attention on the health of munitions workers and furnished the Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, with the perfect general election slogan, Homes Fit for Heroes, a scheme to build 500,000 houses. But in truth, a concern about the poor man at his gate was central to government policy long before. On January the 15th, 1913, workers were able to claim for the first time payments under the National Insurance Act of 1911. The Act provided for unemployment pay that could last 15 weeks, sick pay, claimable for up to 26 weeks, and for low-paid workers, health insurance, allowing them to receive free medical treatment from a panel of local doctors. In every case, the schemes were strictly insurance-based, requiring a track record of contributions. But they also applied, in an even-handed manner, obligations on the government and employers to make contributions too.
Since the 1880s, there had been an increasing concern about poverty and its implications, economic, social and political. And the Liberal governments, certainly from 1908 onwards, after Asquith became Prime Minister, were committed to the idea of social reform based on the state interventionist new liberalism. And it was a central part of their pre-war activity.
Dr. David Powell of York St. John University, who also identifies the political figures responsible for this new liberal thinking.
Lloyd George and Churchill were the two main drivers within the cabinet behind the social reform programme. They did get very good support from Asquith as Prime Minister, but in terms of specific measures like labour exchanges, national insurance, Churchill and Lloyd George were very much behind the social reform programme. Churchill also was someone who was very interested in the ideas of reform. He published important articles, for example, in 1908, an article on the untrodden field in politics, advocating state-sponsored social reform.
We see the curse of unregulated casual employment steadily rotting the underside of the labour market. We see the riddles of unemployment and underemployment quite unsolved.
Wrote Churchill in The Untrodden Field of Politics in 1908. He went on.
It is false and base to say that these evils, and others like them, too many here to set forth, are inherent in the nature of things, that their remedy is beyond the wit of man, that experiment is foolhardy, that all is for the best in merry England. No one will believe it any more. That incredulity is one of the most noteworthy features in the evolution of public opinion today. The nation, which is greater than either party, demands the application of drastic corrective and curative processes and will crown with confidence and honour any party which has the strength and wisdom necessary for that noble crusade.
The legislation born out of their thinking was part of what the firebrand Chancellor of the Exchequer, Lloyd George, had described in his budget speech of 1909 as waging implacable warfare against poverty and squalidness. With that budget, he moved well away from the tradition of Liberal Party economics established by the Victorian Prime Minister, William Ewart Gladstone, who'd emphasised retrenchment and saving public money. Faced with a deficit and harbouring new ambitions for the state, Lloyd George raised income tax sharply, imposed a super tax on higher incomes, increased death duties, and proposed a tax on the increase in value when land was sold. The bitterness of the struggle between Liberals and Conservatives is a shock to any who thought these years a halcyon interlude before the country was engulfed in the war against Germany. Britain had been made painfully aware of the poverty and malnutrition stalking many of its people when the army found it difficult to recruit enough physically fit specimens for the Boer War, which began at the end of the 19th century. Social reformers had published hard-hitting commentary and research, such as Charles Booth's The Life and Labour of the People of London and A Careful Study of Poverty by C. Bohm Rowntree.
Rowntree's Survey of York, Poverty, a Study of Town Life, published in 1901, was the first major study of a provincial city. And what Rowntree did was statistically to demonstrate that poverty was a national problem rather than simply a London problem, that anything up to a third of the population of the country were living below what he described as the poverty line. So he gave statistical evidence on which the politicians could base their policies. It's also the case that Rowntree himself was involved practically in the political reform programme. He'd been an early advocate of old age pensions. He was a close ally of Liberal politicians like Lloyd George, and his ideas and views did very much influence the pre-war Liberal governments. In the later stages of that period, he was also investigating the condition of the rural poor rather than the urban poor, leading to a 1913 study, How the Labourer Lives. And without the work of Rowntree, the Liberal government would have been less well-equipped to carry out the reforms that it did.
The problems and the prospects of the worker on the land have of late aroused so much discussion that the British public is beginning to realise that the welfare of the village labourer is essential to the welfare of the nation as a whole.
C. Bohm Rowntree was part of the famous York family of chocolate makers. They were Quaker pioneers of employer paternalism. His painstaking descriptions of poverty drawn from long interviews and detailed household budgets dispel any idea that country life pre-war was idyllic. For the farm labourer, it was not.
Taking together all these aspects of the life of the agricultural labourer, can we be surprised at his despondent outlook? It may be asked if he has no faith in political or trade union machinery. As regards the first, he seems to be as destitute of faith in politics as of faith in theology. But as regards to the second, he honours, even if he cannot see his way to following, the policy of combination. Here and there we meet a man who has tried to keep a union alive and has been baffled. And of course, it is impossible for the unit to move alone. If I jump out, 10 jumps in. With most of the men, that remark concludes the subject. And yet, especially among the women, there is a slow disturbance, something that is not yet rebellion and not yet hope, that seems to hold the dim promise of both. The waters are troubled, though one hears some very contradictory accounts of the appearance of the angel.
An ominous tone to the conclusion of Rowntree's How the Labourer Lives. It's worth mentioning here that H.H. Asquith, who's perhaps gone down in history as a Prime Minister unsuited to be a war leader, had in the early years of his administration given great latitude to Lloyd George and to Churchill, two of the most dynamic and volatile ministers ever to hold office. Both he and they were prepared to look beyond these shores for fresh ideas. David Powell again.
Lloyd George had visited Germany, and he and Churchill were both very impressed by the Bismarckian reforms of the 1880s. Indeed, Churchill said that what Britain needed to do was to thrust a big slice of Bismarckianism under the social system, by which he meant a state-sponsored welfare system. So foreign examples were very important, not just Germany, but also some examples from the Empire in places like New Zealand, where social measures were being introduced in this time.
In 1908... the government introduced pensions for those aged 70 or more. The weekly amount of 5 shillings was but a fraction of the working man's average pay, but by 1913 a million people were receiving it. The scheme laid the foundation for retirement pensions, which are today received by 10 times as many people. Unlike the Liberals' National Insurance Act, there was no stipulation of a fund. Pensions were paid to people in retirement out of the contributions made by people still in work, a pay-as-you-go system, which, for better or worse, has survived to the present day. That 1909 budget provoked the House of Peers. The government anticipated the fight, having grown weary of seeing its legislation rejected by the inbuilt Tory majority amongst their lordships. Conservative peers regarded the budget as an abomination, and flouting the convention that the elected government should raise and spend money as it judged best, they crushed the budget by a preponderant majority. The government then resigned to fight a peers versus people general election, well before its 7-year mandate was exhausted. Lloyd George enjoyed the campaign, making a series of inflammatory speeches denouncing privilege and illustrating the wretched conditions of the working poor. His pride in the new legislation, as it made its way through Parliament, is caught with all his rhetorical flair in these words of 1912.
So long as the head of the family is in good health, on the whole, with a fierce struggle, he can keep the wolves of hunger in the vast majority of cases from the door. But when he breaks down in health, his children are at the mercy of these fierce, ravaging beasts, and there is no one to stand at the door to fight for the young. What happens in these cases? In hundreds of thousands, there is penury, privation, everything going from the household, nothing left impawned except its pride. On Monday next, an Act of Parliament comes into operation that abolishes that state of things forever. 27 millions of money raised as a fund, raised as a parapet between the people and the poverty that comes from sickness and unemployment. I worked hard at that parapet. Gentlemen, that is the crime for which I stand arraigned. I do not say that it will ensure an era of abundance, but it will inaugurate it.
After 1910, when it needed Labour votes to stay in office, the administration was pushed towards still more ambitious social reforms. Maybe as politics became more concerned with issues of the haves and have-nots, as organised and disorganised Labour became more militant, the patrician liberals, created in the 19th century, moved towards extinction, replaced by a political species better fitted to the changed environment. And if the words of Robert Tressel were anything to go by, from the preface of his novel The Ragged Trousered Philanthropist, published in 1913, the environment had changed radically before the catalyst of a catastrophic war.
I designed to show the conditions relating from poverty and unemployment, to expose the futility of the measures taken to deal with them, and to indicate what I believe to be the only real remedy, namely socialism. I intended to explain what socialists understand by the word poverty, to define the socialist theory of the causes of poverty, and to explain how socialists propose to abolish poverty.
Still, the Liberals left behind a sizeable monument. The National Insurance Act was a colossal piece of legislation. It seems to me as important in creating a welfare state as the legislation of the Labour government in the 1940s. By emphasising the contributory principle, that pioneering Liberal government avoided the dilemma that's dogged welfare reformers since. How to relieve poverty without encouraging benefit dependency, without discouraging thrift and self-reliance. It seems extraordinary and admirable that a government beset by violence and the threat of violence, with much evidence to convince it that the constitution, order, and indeed society were crumbling around it, was able nonetheless to enact so much legislation that set a course for the nation's future.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.